So this morning I'll be presenting Bhikkhu Bodhi's introduction to the khandhas, five aggregates, and that's through the Samyutta Nikaya. And so these are notes or introduction that he's made introducing the Khandha Samyutta, which is a specific section on the khandhas in this Nikaya. The topic of this Samyutta is the five aggregates, Panchakhanda, the primary scheme of categories the Buddha draws upon to analyze sentient existence. Whereas the teaching on dependent origination is intended to disclose the dynamic pattern running through everyday experience that propels the round of birth and death forward from life to life, the teaching on the five aggregates concentrates on experience in its lived immediacy, in the continuum from birth to death. Examination of the five aggregates plays a critical role in the Buddha's teaching for at least four reasons. First, because the five aggregates are the ultimate referent of the first noble truth, the noble truth of suffering. And since all four truths revolve around suffering, understanding the aggregates is essential for understanding the four noble truths as a whole. Second, because the five aggregates are the objective domain of clinging and as such contribute to the causal origination of future suffering. Third, because the removal of clinging is necessary for the attainment of release, and clinging must be removed from the objects around which its tentacles are wrapped, namely the five aggregates. And fourth, because the removal of clinging is achieved by wisdom, and the kind of wisdom needed is precisely clear insight into the real nature of the aggregates. The five aggregates are at once the constituents of sentient existence and the operative factors of lived experience. For within the thought world of the Nikayas, existence is of concern only to the extent that it is implicated in experience. Thus, the five aggregates simultaneously serve the Buddha as a scheme of categories for analyzing human identity and for explicating the structure of experience. However, the analysis into the aggregates undertaken in the Nikayas is not pursued within the aim of reaching an objective scientific understanding of the human being along the lines pursued by physiology and psychology. Thus, comparisons of the Buddha's analysis with those advanced by modern scientific disciplines can easily lead to spurred conclusions. For the Buddha, investigation into the nature of personal existence always remains subordinate to the liberative thrust of the Dhamma. And for this reason, only those aspects of human existence that contribute to the realization of this purpose receive the spotlight of his attention. The word khanda means, among other things, a heap or mass. The five aggregates are so called because they each unite under one label, a multiplicity of phenomena that share the same defining characteristic. Thus, whatever form there is, past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, is incorporated into the form aggregate, and so for each of the other aggregates. Two suttas in the Khandha Samyutta spell out the constituents of each aggregate, doing so in much simpler terms than the latter, more elaborate analysis found in the Visuddhimagga and the commentaries. The breakdown of the aggregates according to the suttas is shown in Table 5. And so in Table 5 he says that the aggregate form has its contents as the four great elements and form derived from them, and its condition is nutriment. For the aggregate feeling, the contents are the six classes of feeling, feeling born of contact through eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, and the condition is contact. For perception, the aggregate of perception, the six classes of perception, perception of form, sounds, odors, taste, tactile, and mental phenomena, and the condition for them is contact. For volitional formations, the contents are the six classes of volition, volition regarding form, sounds, odors, taste, tactiles, and mental phenomena. And again, the condition on that is contact. For consciousness, again, the contents are the six classes of consciousness, eye consciousness, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind consciousness. and the condition for that is name and form. Another sutta explains why each aggregate is called by its assigned name, and it is revealing that these explanations are phrased in terms of functions rather than fixed essences. This treatment of the aggregates as dynamic functions rather than substantial entities already pulls the ground away from the urge to grasp upon them as containing a permanent essence that can be considered the ultimate ground of being. The Khanda Sanyutta stresses in various ways that the five aggregates are dukkha, suffering, a point clearly articulated by the Buddha already in his first sermon when he states, in brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. The aggregates are suffering because they tend to affliction and cannot be made to conform with our desires, because attachment to them leads to sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair, because their change induces fear, distress, and anxiety. Even more pointedly, the five aggregates are already suffering simply because they are impermanent, and thus can never fulfill our hopes for perfect happiness and security. While they give pleasure of joy, which is the gratification in them, eventually they must change and pass away, and this instability is the danger perpetually concealed within them. Though we habitually assume that we are in control of the aggregates, in truth they are perpetually devouring us, making us their hapless victims. To identify with the aggregates and seek fulfillment in them is to be like a man who employs as his servant a vicious murderer out to take his life. So that's what Ajahn Kumudamo read in Sutta 85. The five aggregates are the objective domain of the defilements that bind living beings to the round of existence, particularly the taints, asava, and clinging, upadana. Whatever in the world one might cling to, it is only form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness that one clings to. For this reason, the aggregates that make up our mundane experience are commonly called the five aggregates subject to clinging, pancha upadana khanda. Clinging, it will be recalled, is one of the links in the chain of dependent origination, the link that leads into the production of a new existence in the future. In another sutta, the five aggregates are spliced into the second half of the formula for dependent origination, thereby revealing how clinging to the five aggregates in this existence brings forth a new birth, and thus the reappearance of the five aggregates in the next existence. Another sutta states that because of attachment to the five aggregates, consciousness grows and thrives from life to life. But with the destruction of lust, consciousness becomes unsupported and is then peaceful and liberated. This sutta assigns to consciousness a special place among the five aggregates, since consciousness stands supported by the other aggregates and passes away and undergoes rebirth independence on them. This dictum accords with the suttas on dependent origination that treat consciousness as the channel or vehicle of the rebirth process. Clinging to the five aggregates occurs in two principal modes, which we might call appropriation and identification. In clinging to the aggregates, one either grasps them with desire and lust, chandaraga, and assumes possession of them, or one identifies with them, taking them as the basis for conceit or for views about one's real self. In a phrase often met with in the Khanda Sanyutta, we are prone to think of the aggregates. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. Etang mama, eso hamasmi, eso mi atta. Here, the notion, this is mine, represents the act of appropriation, a function of craving, tanha. The notions, this I am, and this is myself, represent two types of identification, the former expressive of conceit, mana, and the latter of views, ditti, which Ajahn Kumudamo was talking about yesterday. To break our appropriation of the aggregates, the Buddha often enjoins us to abandon desire and lust for them. Sometimes he tells us to abandon the aggregates themselves, for they are as completely alien to us as the twigs and foliage in Jeta's grove. But to give up clinging is difficult because clinging is reinforced by views, which rationalize our identification with the aggregates and thus equip clinging with a protective shield. The type of view that lies at the bottom of all affirmation of selfhood is called identity view, Sakkaya Ditti. All views of self are formulated with reference to the five aggregates, either collectively or individually. The suttas often mention 20 types of identity view obtained by considering oneself to stand in any of the four relations to each of the five aggregates, either as identical with it, as possessing it, as containing it, or as contained within it. The Buddha describes identity view as the leash that keeps the worldling bound to the round of rebirths, revolving in circles like a dog going around a post. He also makes identity view the first of the 10 fetters to be eradicated on the path to liberation. The most common way the suttas distinguish between the uninstructed worldling, asuttava atujana, and the instructed noble disciple, suttava aryasavaka, is precisely by way of identity view. The worldling perpetually regards the aggregates as self or a self's accessories. The noble disciple never does so, for such a disciple has seen with wisdom the selfless nature of the aggregates. As the formula for dependent origination demonstrates, clinging to the five aggregates is ultimately sustained by ignorance, avijja. In relation to the aggregates, ignorance weaves a net of three delusions that nurture desire and lust. These delusions, which infiltrate cognition at a variety of levels, are the notions that the five aggregates are permanent, a source of happiness, and a self, or the accessories of the self. The antidote needed to break the spell of this delusion is wisdom, panya, or knowledge, vijja, which means knowing and seeing the five aggregates as they really are, as impermanent, anicca, as suffering, dukkha, and as non-self, anatta. These are known in the Buddhist traditions as the three characteristics, tilakana, and in the Khanda Samyutta they are extensively applied to the five aggregates in a variety of patterns. The suttas devoted to this theme can be highly repetitive, but the repetition is designed to serve a vital purpose, to strip away the delusions of permanence, pleasure, and selfhood that envelop the five aggregates and keep us trapped in the chain of dependent origination. Perhaps the original nucleus of the Khanda Samyutta consisted of the template suttas along with auxiliary template suttas prevalent in the final 50. These suttas were never intended to be read merely to gather information, but to offer concise instructions on the development of insight, vipassana bhavana. Behind the repetitive utterances, occasionally irksome on first acquaintance, the attentive eye can discern subtle variations attuned to the diversity in the proclivities and intellectual capacities of the people to be guided. Some suttas seem to make the contemplation of one or another of the three characteristics alone sufficient for reaching the goal, though the exegetical texts insist that all must be contemplated to some degree. As the three characteristics are closely intertwined, the most common formula throughout the Nikayas is the one that discloses their internal relationship. This formula, first enunciated in the Buddha's second discourse at Varanasi, uses the characteristics of impermanence to reveal the characteristic of suffering, and both conjointly to reveal the characteristic of non-self. But whatever approach is taken, all the different expositions of the three characteristics eventually converge on the eradication of clinging by showing, with regard to each aggregate, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. The lesson this maxim teaches is that there is no point in appropriating anything, no point in identifying with anything, because the subject of appropriation and identification, the self, is merely a fabrication of conceptual thought woven in the darkness of ignorance. Different suttas from the Khanda Samyutta speak of the three characteristics under various synonyms. And to navigate one's way through this chapter, it is important to recognize which characteristic is being indicated. Thus, the statement that the five aggregates are impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, subject to destruction, to vanishing, to fading away, to cessation, is obviously using different terms to point out the characteristic of impermanence. Less obviously, the sutta on the fragile and the two on arising, vanishing, and alteration are doing the same thing. The suttas that speak of knowing the aggregates as subject to arising and vanishing are also commending contemplation of impermanence. Such suttas as the one on the burden, on misery, and on being devoured emphasize the contemplation of suffering. Among the many suttas that directly expound non-self, one that deserves special attention is the discourse on the lump of foam, which I'll read probably tomorrow or the day, or probably on Monday or the day after. With its striking similes are the empty, insubstantial nature of the aggregates. Besides the three characteristics, the Khanda Sanyutta makes use of other patterns as guidelines for contemplation and understanding. The gratification triad is often applied to the aggregates, sometimes expanded into a pentad by the addition of origin and passing away. So this is the gratification, danger, and escape suttas. Another is the four truth pattern, understanding each aggregate, its origin, its cessation, and the way to its cessation. That's using the Four Noble Truths pattern. A sevenfold hybrid is obtained by merging the fourth truth pattern with the gratification triad. In two suttas, Venerable Sariputta recommends a scheme of 11 ways of attending to the aggregates, obtained by differentiating various aspects of the three characteristics. This method of contemplation, he says, leads all the way from the first steps on the path of meditation to the final stage of arahantship, and can even be recommended to the arahant. According to a stock formula attached to most of the suttas on the three characteristics, the insight into the five aggregates as impermanent, suffering, and non-self induces revulsion, nibbida, dispassion, viraga, and liberation, vimutti. Revulsion is explained by the commentaries as a profound inward turning away from conditioned existence that comes with the higher stages of insight. Dispassion is the supermundane path, particularly the path of arahantship, which eliminates the last traces of craving. Dispassion culminates in liberation, the release of the mind from clinging and the taints, and liberation is in turn ascertained by the subsequent knowledge and vision of liberation, a reviewing knowledge that gives the assurance that the round of rebirths has been stopped and nothing further remains to be done. The Khanda Sanyutta shows that the elimination of clinging occurs in two distinct stages. The first is the elimination of the conceptual types of clinging expressed by wrong views, above all by identity view. This stage of release comes with the breakthrough to the Dhamma, the attainment of stream entry. At this point, the disciple sees the selfless nature of the aggregates and thus overcomes all views of self. For this reason, the defining mark of the instructed noble disciple, the one who has made the breakthrough, is the elimination of every kind of identity view. However, disciples in training, seka, even those at the penultimate stage of non-returner, still retain a subtle notion of I am that continues to linger over the five aggregates like the scent of soap over newly washed clothes. This is spoken of as a residual conceit, I am, a desire, I am, an underlying tendency, I am. However, as the noble disciple continues to contemplate the rise and fall of the aggregates, in time, even this residual notion of I am disappears. It is only the arahant who has fully understood the five aggregates down to the root and thus eradicated the subtlest tendencies to self-affirmation. Elsewhere in the Khanda Sanyutta, the distinction between the trainee and the arahant is drawn in other terms, based on the same principle but differently expressed. One sutta explains that trainees have directly known the five aggregates by way of the four truth pattern and are practicing for their fading away and cessation. Thereby they have gained a foothold in this Dhamma and discipline. Arahants have also directly known the five aggregates by way of the four truth pattern, but they have extirpated all attachment to the aggregates and are liberated by non-clinging. Thus they are called consummate ones for whom there is no round for describing them. While direct knowledge, abhinya, of the aggregates is ascribed to both trainees and arahants, only arahants are said to have full understanding, parinya, of the aggregates, for full understanding implies the destruction of lust, hatred, and delusion. In one sutta, the trainee is described as one who is abandoning the five aggregates and does not cling to them. The arahant, in contrast, is one who neither abandons nor clings, but abides having abandoned. Another sutta, stream enterer, is defined as one who understands the five aggregates by way of their origin passing away, gratification, danger, and escape, while the arahant is one who, having understood the aggregates thus, is liberated by non-clinging. Thus, these passages indicate the essential difference between the trainee and the arahant to consist in the extent to which they have developed liberating knowledge. The trainee has arrived at this knowledge and thereby eliminated the conceptually explicit types of ignorance crystallized in wrong views, but he has not yet fully utilized it to eradicate the emotively tinged types of ignorance manifest as clinging. The arahant has mastered this knowledge and fully developed it, so that in his mind all the defilements along with the subtlest shades of ignorance have been abolished. The trainee might be compared to a person walking along a mountain path who catches a distant glimpse of a splendid city, but must still walk across several more mountains to reach his destination. The arahant is like one who has arrived at the city and now dwells comfortably within its bounds. Beneath its repetitiveness and copious use of template formulas, the Khamsanyutta is a rich compilation of texts, and no brief introduction can do justice to all its suggested themes. Special mention, however, might be made of the Theravada, the fourth Vaga on the elder monks. Here we find Ananda's first-hand account of his breakthrough to the Dhamma while listening to a discourse on the aggregates. Another is Sariputta's refutation of the annihilationist interpretation of Nibbana, and Anuruddha's puzzlement about the Tathagata's status after death, which is what Ajahn Vrindavana read. Anuruddha, that's correct. The story of Wakali, who attained final Nibbana while dying at his own hand, and another, the Kamaka Sutta, which Ajahn Vrindavana read, on the distinction between the trainee and the arahant, and the story of the refractory monk Chana, whose change of heart proved abundantly fruitful for him. So that's Bhikkhu Bodhi's well-written introduction to the khandhas. I think we'll probably get through half of this. This is from Ajahn Suchito, and it's called The World of the Five Aggregates. This reflection was offered on the morning of November 25th, 2014, and this is from The Most Precious Gift, the compilation of Ajahn Suchito's teachings throughout his life. This is the direct way for the realization of Nibbana, for the ceasing of suffering and stress, for the purification of beings. Namely, the mindfulness that is framing and referring to experience in four aspects: body, kaya, feeling, vedana, mind states, citta, and what are called dhammas. This fourth aspect is in relation to the other three as we sustain mindfulness on the body, feeling, and mind states. Things such as ill will, investigation, sense desire, and joy arise. It's a crucial and key aspect because as the awareness is with the body, or feeling, or mind states, it's telling us whether there's the dissonance of struggling and resistance, or whether there's something more inquiring and investigating. In a way, these dhammas indicate whether the relationship between awareness and its object is dysfunctional, antagonistic, not really there yet, or if it's beginning to settle. The first culminating enlightenment factor is unification, samadhi. When things are completely settled, there's no differentiation in the subject-object, no me holding it, no tugging, no infatuations, no contractions. It's just an open and steady state. The other culminating enlightenment factor is equanimity, which is the tone of that unification. The mind is very even. It doesn't waver. It doesn't go in. It doesn't go out. It doesn't grab an object. There isn't the sense of me struggling with it or it getting on top of me. When there is a differentiation in the subject-object, there is a splitting and a clashing. The me sense becomes strong and is often besieged, struggling, afflicted, or needy. And that feels very much like who I am as an identity. That experience is actually coming out of an unconscious relationship that's distorted by a lack of deep penetrative insight. But the Buddha is saying that it doesn't have to happen. That doesn't mean that the real self gets extinguished. There isn't a real self to be extinguished or a self to be let go of or an ego to be transcended. These expressions are just simplifications. There's a relationship that needs to be fulfilled, and in that relationship there isn't the creation of a separate self who is struggling with, controlling, on top of, or underneath the experience it seems to be having. You're not separate from an experience. How can you be separate from what you are experiencing? Yet that separation is the usual setup, but when you think about it, it's not really logical. There's something weird about it, and yet it's also extremely normal because we are all following the same pattern. We're all singing from the same hymn book, so it sounds like it's real. There can be functioning, understanding, clarity, or humor, but the sense of the person there who is trying to make it work or isn't getting it right, and so forth, doesn't have to occur. There's the ceasing of that which has arisen, which is being formed, concocted, created, constructed. There's no annihilation of a real being. There's the ceasing to construct a ghost and a puppet who always feels unhappy, not necessarily deeply unhappy, but something is always bothering him or her. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the phrase independent, not clinging to anything in the world, is an easy one to roll off your tongue. But it requires a bit of working out because we may not really understand the terms independent, clinging, and world. The world is constructed by the sense fields, the three-dimensional reality which I am sort of separate from but on the edge of, is a constructed thing. It's particularly evident through the eyes which always place everyone else out there and me in here. The play between the eyes and the mind generates this split, and then I'm trying to find my place in the world or change it, or I feel overwhelmed by it. This world is actually all the six sense fields, which are the external sense bases, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body, and the internal one, which is the mind, or more precisely, the mind organ, mano. There are two words for mind, mano and citta. Mano refers to the operating, organizing, doing functions. The citta is the mentality, the property of awareness, knowing that things are happening. It's the basic receptivity that resonates with and is affected by experience. Sometimes people use the word heart for citta, but although it's emotive, it's not just an emotional faculty. The citta is that which can be brightened, gladdened, steadied, and released. The Buddha is said to be one who abides with a purified or emancipated citta, a citta which is gathered into the deathless. The world is essentially constructed by the play between the external sense organs and the internal organ of the mind, bouncing the inputs around, organizing them, considering them, comparing them, contrasting them, referring them, resisting them, and so on. But one of the snags with that analysis is that we can easily come into a position where the external sense is the world and the internal sense, the mind organ, is the me watching the world, me dealing with the world. The world is out there and I'm in here. I am the mind that is doing all of this, knowing, watching, witnessing, pulling levers, and so forth. We may have a certain detachment, but it's a detachment that can give rise to conceit, indifference, and a dissociation effect. We live in our heads. Another analysis of the world is called the five khandhas. Khanda is rather a mysterious term meaning something like conglomerate or aggregate. There are five khandhas, and each of them is a conglomerate of factors. So the world is a conglomerate made up of conglomerates, bits and pieces that stick together. The first aggregate is rupa, form, which is the sticking together of the qualities of earth, solidity, water, harmony or cohesiveness, heat, temperature and vitality, and air, movement. The visual forms are easy to discern. You can look at the human body and reflect on what gives the body its shape. If you take a body and burn it down, you just have ashes that don't cohere at all. It could be any old shape. The shape of body is contributed by water. That's what sticks it together into a cohesive form. Without water, it would just crumble into dust. But of course, if it were just water, it wouldn't be able to hold on any pressure. You would be oozing all over the floor, absorbing into the carpet. So there's a certain amount of earth, just enough to create the right soupy, muddy quality that holds it. There's a certain rigidity to it, and of course, the most rigid parts of the body that we experience are the bones. The vitality or heat is an important element we can experience in our body. You can't always see warmth through the eyes, but you can discern brightness, light, and vitality. The last element is air or mobility. A living body is always moving, breathing in, breathing out. That's the most obvious sign of it, but there are also subtler movements, such as the shifting of energy through the limbs. These subtler movements are part of the larger sense of what we mean by breathing. Particularly in the Eastern context, breathing is not reduced to the movement of the air. It's also a movement of qi, prana, or vitality. We can see these four elements blending and merging to different degrees, and that blending makes up the first aggregate of rupa. The second aggregate is vedana, feeling. There are three kinds of feelings: pleasant, painful, and neutral. And each of them is based on two fundamental bases, body and mind, so there are six kinds of feelings. The third aggregate is sanya, perception, which refers to signs, signals, memories, meanings, felt meanings, the impressions we get from things. For example, that strikes me as interesting, or bright, or sad, or it seems like a cow to me, or it sounds like a bell. Perceptions are constructed and contextual. They create categories for experience. Often you assemble a perception to a whole range of things. If it's mental and you strike it with a hammer and it makes a ringing sound, it's a bell. We have a certain group-held perception of bellness, and as the sound changes, we can all agree that it's not a bell anymore. It drops out of the bell category into the buzzer category or the alarm clock category. Or the chime category. And of course, you can subdivide these. That's not a bell, that's a gong, or that's a wind chime. Perception is just a relative understanding which groups together a bunch of experiences into manageable packets that we can relate to. In fact, everything is specifically itself. No bell is like another one. But that would be very difficult to communicate if we didn't use words, wouldn't it? So we have large topics such as bell or cow. No cow is like another cow. There are Frisians, Jerseys, and so on, and each cow has its own individual qualities as well. But we can use the category of cow. At a certain point, we might say, that's an ox, and then you can quibble over whether it's really an ox cow or an oryx. When does a cow become an ox, and so on, but basically it's a cow. It moves. When does a dog become a wolf? Let's say you have a wolf and an Alsatian, and you crossbreed them. You look at them and their offspring and say, that's an Alsatian. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. That's an Alsatian with a bit of wolf blood in it. That's an Alsatian with a lot of wolf blood in it. That's mostly wolf and not much Alsatian. That's a wolf. Where is the dividing line? Perceptions are really a matter of opinion. They are concoctions, and yet we act upon them. Whatever the mind has constructed something as, we respond to it. The response is sankhara. And that's the fourth aggregate. Dog, nice, pat it. Wolf, terrible, run away from it. Sankharas are activations, mental formations, kama activities, impulses, the qualities of intentionality that jump up. This is a fairly easy way to handle this rather complex term. Sankharas could be associated with loving kindness, compassion, malice, greed, or fear. All kinds of impulses can rise up. Out of the rising of feeling, perception, and sankhara, we have the experience called emotion. The last aggregate, vijnana, consciousness, is the potential to receive impressions. It's the messenger. Consciousness is a property that brings a basic entry of experience into awareness. If you are not conscious of something, it doesn't happen. Consciousness occurs through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and thinking mind. It receives things in different ways depending on whether it's affected by fear or wisdom and so forth. You can be slightly paranoid or edgy. You can also have impaired eyesight. For example, not being able to differentiate brown from green, or hearing difficulties so you don't get it. You can end up identifying with that and thinking, I'm stupid or inadequate, but it's all just a matter of consciousness, which is a conditioned factor. It has limitations. It brings what it can. How is it then considered the world? Actually, I'm gonna start there again. I think that's enough. Well, one thing that would I think be an assumption is in that is that the sense of the five khandhas exists as like a linear position that we experience form and then we and then feeling and perception and there's sort of these separate things we're going through in time. And so my own sense of it is that it's not linked in that exact way. They're all kind of these experiences we have that are taken out of like one larger heap, or heaps that are all kind of together, or they're kind of linked in a very clear way. So I think the cognizing element, that the knowing would still be present for the other four khandhas. But I think that maybe one of the reasons why it's listed in that way in terms of cognizing is that it's sort of like a much grander perceptual bringing in of those four khandhas, that experience in itself. So it's like while perception leads to a sense of something, and sankhara is a more complicated, as Rinpoche Suchito was saying, like implication of what we take from that perception, how we kind of run with it. The cognizing is the sense of knowing it, you know, like consciousness cognizes is what the Buddha says. So its function is a knowing element. So it's sort of bringing in all of these characteristics together, and we could say like weaving them together in a certain way so that the mind cognizes, it knows experience. And it's sort of like, it's also to me, consciousness is like the appearance of something. So like, it has a recognizing quality to it. It's not just like, it's sort of like apprehending or like taking in all of these things in a knowledgeable way. So that's how I would explain it. Not that like last is least or last is at the end, but more that's how consciousness functions. I think I added that.
Yeah, definitely, in the sense that it has an integrative function, and so it makes sense for it to be listed at the end, because again, it's the, as Bhikkhu Bodhi says, they are described more by function. Also, to recognize that it's not a concrete disparate. These are not concrete disparate qualities, and that it's sort of using an indistinct term.
I thought it was that there are heaps. There are heaps of the same.
Well, no. I mean, even I think it's a sutta. Putta is
talking. Is he using the word not disjoined but conjoined? Or
that's the word.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. They are conjoined. They are not disjoined. I was trying to remember the word, and that's. It's important to remember that. These are not completely separate things, but they are conjoined.
Yeah, consciousness has kind of the unifying, kind of weaves nama and rupa.
Yeah, that's why that's the image of the conjurer's trick in the level four sutta is really relevant. Because it makes something out of nothing.
It seems like in one light too, you can say the consciousness would come right after the body within the definition of that fifth kanda, consciousness, right? It's applying to the six senses, body being one of them. The body consciousness, but it also applies to the other sense bases, including the mind, which is, relevant to Vedana, Sanya, and Sankara. So consciousness, as I see it, as I understand it anyway, consciousness's role is in relation to all of nama rupa, body and mind, not just. And it weaves all four of the first of the five khandhas into a unifying experience of me, usually.
Basically.
Me.
It's all
me. Yeah, that's a further good example that all of this is just mushed together.
Just one big mushed together mess.
It's kind of, I like the idea, but like it's like a, as conjoined or a heap, it's sort of like the Buddha's trying to pull out qualities of something that's together, you know, just to enunciate, like, these are the qualities of this thing, so you can kind of like, you can't, it seems like when he talks about things, it's like this disjointed, like, I can separate these things, or I can separate this experience, but it's like, Ajahn Sikidoli uses the word felt sense of something, so it's like, just like, the form kind of is like this, and feeling is kind of like that, but it's all part of the same continual experience.
This one small, more back on the first reading. It's a translation thing in terms of in the just in the same yuta, Bhikkhu Bodhi diverges from his usual translation of nibbida as disenchantment, but in here he uses the word revulsion.
Oh yeah,
might be startling to some people. I haven't heard that before.
So, right. Yeah,
a very strong translation, but then with the Anguttara Bhagavan, what he did after that, he reverted back to disenchantment.
It's a, yeah, definitely a softer word.
Well, to me it's more accurate too, you know, losing the, has more of a seeing clearly component, you're no longer enchanted, as opposed to just like revulsed by sin.
Yeah. I mean, that's just because of tendency towards aversion. Revulsion has a feeling of aversion.
My use of the word.
Okay, well, it's 10:35, so we can tend to a form.